Hi, you're watching DNA Today, a multi-award-winning genetics podcast where we explore everything to do with genetics, from CRISPR to rare diseases to new research. We have won the Science in Medicine Podcast Award for many years now. We have hundreds of episodes, and we really hope you enjoy these conversations where we dive into so many genetic concepts. I'm Kira Dineen, a certified genetic counselor and your host. Hello, we are back in NBC's Stanford studios. Very exciting to be joined by two amazing guests who are going to be exploring ENPP1 deficiency. So I'm joined by Christine O'Brien, who is a co-founder of Gaki Global and who has two children with a disorder. Also joined by Dr. Eve Sabag, who is the chief scientific officer at Enzyme. So as I said, we're going to be diving into ENPP1 deficiency. So Dr. Sabag, I thought I would start with you just to give us a little bit of an overview. So for this disorder, we are referring to it differently throughout someone's life depending on how old they are. So can you kind of dive into that a little bit deeper and give the audience more of an understanding of some of the verbiage we use and just understanding ENPP1 deficiency overall?
Sure, happy to do that. And you are right, it is a spectrum of disease and it's a progression of the disease, and that's why the name changes. So initially it's diagnosed as GACI, which stands for Generalized Arterial Calcification of Infancy. And this is when infants, even prenatally through ultrasound, you can detect the extensive calcification in their arteries. And unfortunately, it's a high mortality rate in the first 6 months, about 50%. And then those that do survive the 6 month then end up having what's called ARHR2, which stands for autosomal recessive hypophosphatemic rickets type 2. And that's basically skeletal disease where they have rickets, phosphate wasting through the kidney. And then through, as they progress through adulthood, you get what's called osteomalacia, because rickets is a pediatric bone disease, not specific, and osteomalacia is where the adults form. And they still have other complications that are also, so it is a progression of the disease.
Yeah, basically. So it's a little different than I would say other genetic disorders, where when someone's diagnosed, we continue using that same term for the condition throughout their life. So it is a little bit different. I had to learn a little bit more, and then you phrased it so nicely to kind of solidify it in my mind. So obviously, because we're talking about it here on DNA Today, this is a genetic disorder. So what are the genes that can lead to ENPP1 deficiency overall? And is there multiple genes? Is there one? What does that look like?
Yeah, so ENPP1 deficiency is, as the name states, it's due to mutations in the ENPP1 gene. ENPP1 is a major enzyme that produces a key molecule called pyrophosphate, or I'll be referring to it as PPI as well. And so that gene is basically what's in GACI, and there's two types of GACI. GACI type 1, which is due to mutations in ENPP1, but there's also a GACI type 2, which is also, you get the same presentation of calcification in infancy, and that's due to another gene in the same pathway called ABCC6. Which is a transporter of the key substrate for ENPP1, so that's how they're related.
So now I'm diving into, in my mind, like looking at genetic pathways and then, how we're producing proteins from that. So deep dive question here. So ENPP1, is that earlier in the pathway than the other gene you just mentioned? And does that affect the severity and symptoms of the disorder?
Downstream, because ABCC6 is the transporter that brings the substrate ATP from inside to outside the cell. Mm-hmm. Then ATP is metabolized to pyrophosphate or PPI, which is needed in the body.
But
it is the reason the severity of the diseases are a bit different between, because ABCC6 deficiency also has a progression. In adulthood, it's known as pseudoxanthoma elasticum, because then you get also calcifications in the eye, you have vision loss, you have calcifications in the skin, as well as some cardiovascular abnormalities that occur.
Okay. So it's interesting that we say ENPP1 deficiency, knowing, a lot of people will have a mutation or what we say pathogenic variant in that gene, but it also could be this other gene you're mentioning. Okay, and so for diagnosis, I imagine genetic testing must be very important for this. Is there other types of screening or testing to help give us this diagnosis, or is it really just genetic testing?
Well, you know, as we talked about mentioning the two different genes, the genetic testing will be important to really understand which gene is mutated in these patients, because the disease progression will be different between the two. But like I mentioned, by ultrasound in the second trimester, you can actually detect the calcifications. It's usually not commonly done unless it's there's a history in the family that they can screen that way. But genetic testing is usually the confirmatory way of to go about it.
So. I see. We could see signs of it, but then we're going to lead to genetic testing to get that diagnosis.
Correct.
But we could have other, you know, red flags or heads up. Okay, maybe we're headed in that direction. And I think you bring up a good point that we can potentially pick this up prenatally. So, but looking at that, we've talked about how this can affect someone throughout their life. So it's not just OBs, MFMs that should be aware of this and signs to look for, but also we should have pediatricians be aware of this. We should
Correct.
Have, you know, general practitioners that are treating adults be aware of this. What are some of those signs that these healthcare providers should be aware of in those different areas to say, could this be an ENPP1 disorder? Mm-hmm. Should I be looking further into it or reach out to experts like you guys?
Yeah. So no, that's a very important, and you're being, you know, as it's a rare disease, so there's not a lot. So some doctors have never seen these patients. So I think education is the most important. We have an amazing team at Inozyme that we go and educate about these
like
diseases.
Like we're doing today, yes, very
exactly.
much so.
Exactly, and this is a perfect forum to do that as well. Because you're right, we need to, like I said, during ENPP1 deficiency, there's ARHR2, so type 2 rickets. That means there's a type 1 rickets. And there's autosomal dominant, autosomal recessive. So it's if you have rickets, you need to know which types of rickets you need to do. And so there's other phenotypes. It's also the calcification or other hearing loss also in our patients is observed. So educating, making the links, because sometimes you can't just have one drug that will be appropriate for all the others. And that's why it's very important. So education, we're out there in... doing what we're doing today, as well as going to conferences and going into the hospitals and educating. Because we meet doctors as well that say, oh, I've heard about this in medical school, but they might have never seen it. But sometimes we also talk to doctors and they come back and say, wait a minute, I might have seen a case like this. And they go back in their records and then they'll confirm that it was really a patient with ENPP1 deficiency. So.
And important to include this on a differential diagnosis as they're trying to figure it out, because a lot of times on the show here we're talking about a certain disorder and then we can go retroactively and be like, okay, well, if we're talking about this disorder, these are some of the symptoms
exactly.
we might see and all this, but in reality we have a patient that has symptoms and we're like, okay, what conditions could fit with this? So doing the education that you both are just doing such a wonderful job at is so important, so that healthcare providers know, oh, should I include ENPP1 deficiency on the list of potentials.
Yeah.
So Christine, we gotta loop you in here because you have a personal touch to the GACI community. You have two children with the disorder. So I would, love to know a little bit more about your kiddos and how you got involved in the community, because you're co-founder of GACI Global. So that is a really big role that you have within this ultra rare community. So tell me a little bit about how that started for
you. Sure. So my first child was born prematurely and had a lot of health issues that we assumed were related to prematurity, but they were kind of weird and didn't really fit that preemie phenotype or whatever you want to call it. They didn't fit into prematurity being the cause. And so he had some testing done. He had significant calcification in both of his shoulders. And I mean, he couldn't raise his arms up very high at all, like above 90 degrees. Couldn't crawl because his shoulders were so affected. So we went through this, testing process with ultrasounds and MRIs, and we didn't really get an answer. Like, it was just, there's calcification there. We don't really know why. And during one of these tests, they noted he had tortuous vessels in his neck that were indicative of a connective tissue disease. So long story short, he ends up getting diagnosed with a connective tissue disease, not related at all to ENPP1 deficiency. Mm-hmm. But my husband then was diagnosed as well. So now we have this genetic disease in our family. I was 9 months pregnant, and so I said, is there a chance this baby could have this disease as well? So they sent me in for a fetal echo and discovered that the baby's arteries were significantly calcified. And so that's when we first were introduced to the world of Gacky.
Wow.
And we were told that at this point, we were told 85% of babies with this disease die. We know that statistic now is 50%. But at that time, that's what we were told. So, you know, it was heartbreaking. We didn't know what was going to happen. They delivered her a few days later, and there was nothing out there when we started Googling, like any parent does when their kid
is
diagnosed.
10-ish years ago.
Yeah, so. She'll be 11 in February, beginning of February. So, yeah, more than a decade ago, there was nothing out there. We were Googling and finding outdated information and scary information, like that 85% statistic. And there was one other family who had been treated at our hospital, and so the doctors put us in touch with them. And it was just such a light, like this bright light of hope, to connect with another family who had a baby that survived. And so I sort of made it my mission to find more families. and, you know, we used the internet and connected with some families in Australia and Ireland and the UK. And we were sort of spread all over the place. And
hence Gacky Global.
Yes, so, exactly.
Yes, very much so.
So we started this private Facebook group, just a, you know, support group online. And that was back in 2013 when my daughter was a baby. And then from there, we've grown. In 2018, we came together at the Global Genes Conference in California. It was the first time that a lot of us had met in person.
Yeah, sure, because it's so international.
Yeah.
So you can, you know, get on Zoom and everything. But to actually meet in person, that must have been such an experience just to see them after developing the relationships, but to say, wow, okay, you're real.
Yes.
I think that's the experience we have of having Zoom relationships.
You know, to be able to put your arms around those people that provided support for you in your darkest time was just incredible. And so Gacky Global was born there in California in 2018.
Wow. And you've just, as we've been saying, you've talked to so many families and I'm sure developed these relationships for... A lot of our viewers are healthcare providers or fellow rare disease parents, caregivers. With that in mind, what challenges has your family or other families experienced just in terms of a Gacky diagnosis and managing the healthcare system? Because managing the healthcare system is really tough with rare disorders because oftentimes you're explaining to new healthcare providers, well, this is the diagnosis of my child or children. And they don't know it, and then you're the expert in the room, but typically it's the other way around. So I know a lot of rare disease families experience that, but anything more particular to Gacky?
I mean, I think you said it. For most of the patients in our community, the parents are the experts.
Yes, and we need to acknowledge that. Like, you know way more about this disorder than I do. I have training in genetic counseling, but I've learned about this disorder through both of you.
And we live with it every single day.
Yeah.
So we are often educating doctors about it. Even at the best hospitals, they don't understand the broad spectrum of this disease.
And you're Boston-based, so you've got a lot of great healthcare centers around you.
We're very lucky in that way, yeah. But a lot of families, like you said, this is a global thing. They don't have access necessarily to the best hospitals or the experts on the condition. So some of the challenges can be, are there local doctors willing to accept help or advice from other medical teams? Sometimes that answer is no, unfortunately, which can be really frustrating for our families. Fortunately, we do have many that are willing to accept the help, and we have experts on this disease, you know, in the U.S. and in Europe that are willing to connect with families and doctors and provide whatever help they can, which I think helps our families a lot. And it's nice to have somebody that's willing to learn more about the disease and then advocate for you.
Yeah, because it is a team. It's you advocating for your kids, but also having medical providers on your side to even help with that even further. And I want to pick both of your brains on a topic that we explore a lot on the show. Newborn screening is something that we've been talking about and how that's going to be changing in the future. We've had newborn screening for, what, Dr. Sabag, you probably have to correct me, but I want to say 60-ish years, started with PKU, probably, and we've grown a lot. We've talked on the show, and we've had Dr. Kingsmore on from Rady Children's, who's really a leader in the field. We were just chatting about him before we started today. And it seems like the direction we're going in is whole genome sequencing. I don't think we're going to get there like by the end of the year or anything, and we may see it in other countries. But what's your viewpoint in terms of how close we are to this and how it's going to help the ENPP1 deficiency community, including the GACI community? Yeah. I don't know, Dr. Sabag, if you want to start us out.
Sure, yeah. So I completely agree. I think whole genome sequencing is going to be important to also diagnose quicker. You know, the journey of diagnosing rare disease patients in general takes years sometimes because they're so rare and that doctors are not familiar. So we are founding members of a Beginnings Consortium, which is a sponsored program at Rady's Genomics Institute for infants suspected with GACI1 as well as GACI2, so it's ENPP1 and ABCC6 genes. But it's a whole genome sequencing until the age of 1 year old in all newborns in that healthcare system. And eventually we hope that this will expand more because the earlier you identify these genes, mutations, the better you can address the disease and prevent further deterioration.
Yeah, prevention is key for so many different disorders. Yeah. And it used to be with newborn screening, and I guess still is, you know, universally throughout the U.S. Can't really comment on Canada and UK and other countries, but that we would only include conditions that have a known treatment that if we give that treatment, it would prevent symptoms. Yeah. And so it had certain criteria, but it kind of seems like maybe we're expanding that because it's that concept is very old. It made sense decades ago, but does it make sense now?
Exactly. You know, the fields are advancing quicker. There's the more, you know, we are looking into programs where we can get the prenatal diagnosis before drugs are, there's any drug to approve just for, you still get better treatment for the whatever's available, whether to treat a certain symptom, than having the patients go through these years of not knowing what specifically they have.
Right, and I think that's a major point. Christine, would you agree with that in terms of the diagnostic odyssey being so long? Like, how would your life have changed if your son, who's older, was diagnosed prenatally or as a newborn with newborn screening?
I mean, we would just have known so much more about why he was dealing with these issues, and there wouldn't have been such questions hanging in the air of, nobody has seen this before. Why are his shoulders so calcified? Why can't any of the doctors explain it? You know, it would have been nice to have an answer, and even though we eventually got that answer, and it was a hard and heartbreaking answer, there wasn't that same anxiety about what is causing this. There was relief to know what it was, and, you know, then we made plans on what we could do next.
Right. The unknown is very scary. We know that just from just different areas of our life. If we know something, we're like, okay, we can be anxious about this. But if we don't know anything, we're like, oh, where does the anxiety start and end? I think that that must just be so, so difficult for, you know, yourself and other parents that are in that situation. And you've talked about some of the symptoms in terms of, you know, calcification and your son not being able to raise his arms like past 90 degrees. What are some other daily challenges and how has that changed throughout? Your son's 13 now and your daughter's 11, almost. So how has that changed throughout their life and also of talking with other families? How does it affect more into adulthood?
Sure. I mean, like you've said, it's a spectrum of disorders and it changes over the course of a patient's lifetime. And even for siblings, you know, in the same family, they can have very drastically different disease
courses. Even with
the
same genetic mutation.
With the exact same genetic mutation. And that was evident in my own family. My son didn't have any of the arterial calcification as an infant, but he had the severe joint calcification. My daughter, on the other hand, had severe arterial calcification and GI issues as a result of lack of blood flow to her GI system. I mean, she cried for her first 6 months of life because she was just in such pain. It was awful. And as they grew, then those issues and or signs and symptoms sort of changed. The complications, new complications arose. So when my son was about 3 and a half, we noticed that he was asking us, "What? What?" and turning his right ear to us. And we said, "I think he might not be hearing us," and took him in for a hearing test. And he'd already had ear tubes as a toddler, so he had a history of hearing tests that were perfectly normal. So this was a new concern, and he was diagnosed with moderately severe hearing loss. And at that time, we didn't know that this could be a complication of the disease. Now we know, like, 50% or something of
right,
patients.
Right, that's in the literature, like, yes. from Enzyme and other yep. ones that I've read in terms of, okay, like, hearing loss. Because yep. when we think about calcifications, we're like, well, where can that affect? We think about bones and joints, but also there's a lot of important little tiny bones in the ear. So yep. to correct. Me, that makes sense of having a rudimentary understanding.
Yeah. So now we know that a significant portion of the population deal with hearing loss over the course of their life. Both of my kids have a lot of fatigue. Like, we were just on a trip and we would have to take so many breaks because they just don't have that same stamina to walk long distances. You know, my six-year-old can walk further than they
who
can
doesn't
sometimes.
Have the disorder.
Yes, yes, she doesn't have this disorder. And then for the teens and adults in our community, they deal with increasing bone pain, fatigue. They deal with calcific enthesopathy, which is calcification in their joints. Okay. Which is progressive, and there's no effective treatment for it. So really all we can offer these patients is pain management. They can deal with cervical spine fusion. Mm-hmm. Actually, my son has cervical spine fusion.
Does that limit his mobility of being able to move his neck then?
He's lucky in that it hasn't so far, but it okay. can progress. It can get worse. Okay. And there are other patients in our community who are severely limited in their range of motion. And you know, to see those adult patients just dealing with pain and stiffness and it's getting progressively worse is really hard to watch. Yeah. And to know that that's in the future for my kids if things don't change.
Right, because you're at a point with your kids being almost 11 and 13 of you're looking back at people that are in the prenatal stage of doing ultrasounds. Like you said, you had done a fetal echocardiogram, which is a ultrasound of baby's heart at that point. But then, you know, going through childhood and now you're entering the teen years for them. So you're looking back at some of those previous years and talking to families in those situations, but then also looking forward in terms of, okay, well, what should we have on our radar and things to mentally prepare for seems to be where we're at.
Yeah.
But I'm learning that treatment is evolving. Dr. Sabag, maybe you would be a good person to kind of shed more light on this and the clinical trials happening. Where are we at with this? Because it seems to be much more promising than it was 10 years ago when we would Google and, as Christine was saying, would not get a lot of information. So, you know, let's spin this to be, yeah. where are we going? What's hopeful? Where are we at with treatment?
Yeah, so we're very busy at Inozyme. You know, it's our goal is to get a treatment for the Gaki community and beyond. And so we do have an enzyme replacement therapy that is being used to address the missing enzyme ENPP1. And we are in clinical trials. We had clinical trials in adults with ENPP1 as well as ABCC6 deficiency. Mm-hmm. Which we started a couple of years ago, and there we've reported some of the nice data with that.
Oh, good.
We started last year a phase 1b, so it's a safety and tolerability study in infants, so Gaki patients. So that's ongoing still, and we also initiated trials in phase 3 in pediatric patients. So we are looking at all the spectrum.
I was going to say, you hit all the different areas.
Exactly, because I think
about.
It's important. There's a burden of disease in all of the population, so we are looking into addressing. And we're excited and working very closely with Gaki Global and other patient advocacy groups to really help understand you know, what the patient needs are as well as addressing the unmet mm-hmm. need.
And it's really important, I think, you know, as a third party outside of this, it really warms my heart to see when we have pharmaceutical companies like Enzyme working with patient advocacy groups to come together to be like, okay, what does the patient advocacy group need and how can we fit into that? Christine, how has it been of, you know, having this collaboration with Enzyme and how has that I want to say partnership. I don't know if that's the right legal term, but just in terms of coming at it from a collaborative approach, How has the patient community really responded to this? And have you guys been able to have these conversations of this is what we need? What has that looked like?
Yeah, we've been really lucky in our relationship with Inozyme.
I figured you guys are here together, so that was kind of a softball question.
I mean, our missions align. We want to improve the lives of patients with ENPP1 deficiency and ABCC6 deficiency. So we're very lucky in that way. They're very receptive to our feedback. We've had the opportunity to review, you know, clinical trial protocols and listen to what we think is important to our patients and to our community, and they are very receptive and take that feedback and incorporate it. And we just had a conference a couple of weeks ago where a couple of members from Inozyme came over and, you know, got to meet the patients firsthand, and they were so good at listening to what is important to our patients, and I think they brought that back to the company and shared it. So yeah, we are very lucky.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful. And I think when it comes to clinical trials, you need that. You need to be an active participant in it and not just, okay, you're, you know, this person entering the trial and you're this number or something. That it's much different to be active in it with the clinical trial. Dr. Sabag, when it comes to the clinical trial, I imagine, you know, they're just like all clinical trials, there is inclusion criteria, so not everybody is going to meet that to be able to be enrolled in the clinical trial. For healthcare providers to know, what are we looking at in terms of, okay, if they have a patient that's similar to XYZ, what would that include? And then how can they get someone kind of introduced into the clinical trial to see if they're a match in terms of meeting with, I don't know, if that's an Inozyme rep or something like that. Or are you not, you know, taking anyone at this time?
No. So, for the adult trials, those trials have been completely fully enrolled. For the infant and pediatrics, obviously, we're still enrolling.
Okay.
The criteria are available. It's publicly available.
Great. We'll link to that in the show notes.
Clinicaltrials.gov. Mm-hmm. You know, you can find them. There are inclusion criteria. Usually, the doctor will can contact us and to be participate in the trial, and we have a screening period before to see if their patients will be eligible for the trial. So it's pretty well.
And it's very standard.
It is very standard, and unfortunately, there's some patients that are not always eligible. But but eventually, you know, we try to get as many patients that will be able to participate in the trials.
Right. So. And I imagine one of the inclusion criteria might be to have a genetic diagnosis with genetic
that's
testing.
Correct.
Sometimes genetic testing can be expensive. It depends. It's lowered the cost like the last 10 years, even longer, but, you know, really lowered the cost. But it can still be an obstacle for certain people. Is there any testing programs that can offset the cost so that patients and caregivers are not paying that, or is that something that we're still looking into, you know, as a community?
No, from the beginning, Inozyme's had a sponsored program where we cover suspected cases of ENPP1 or ABCC6 deficiency through a program, Prevention Genetics.
Sure.
Again, it's there's links on our website for that,
great.
But yeah, we cover the cost, the help get the samples shipped to get
prevention.
To prevention and the. And then the results are shared with the clinician and stuff.
Good. Yeah. So that's also good for healthcare providers to know that they're suspecting this disorder. Then, we could set it up through Inozyme. You guys
correct.
Are kind of, it sounds like, footing the bill for that so that people, that's not going to be a challenge and a hindrance for people to be able to eventually get into the clinical trial, get that diagnosis.
Yeah. Exactly.
So that's wonderful. It really is.
Yeah. And it's important to know, like I said earlier, the gene.
Yes.
You know, is it ENPP1? Is it ABCC6? Because there are going to be different trials.
Right. Get this right, either GACI1 or 2, depending on the gene. Did I get it?
Yeah.
All right. I think I learned something in this episode. So, no, more than something. So, Dr. Sabag, when it comes to the clinical trial then, so the medication, if I'm getting this right, is the INZ-701. So, from my understanding, you were very key in developing this. Maybe you were the lead of it. You have to correct me here. So, how does that work? How did you develop the medication, and how does that actually help patients? I guess from a molecular perspective, of what's actually changing in their body, of what the medication is doing, but then also what symptoms is it either reducing or alleviating altogether? How does that work?
Yeah. So INZ-701 was the, you know, developed at Inozyme, but the technology comes from licensing from Yale University, from the Dr. Braddock's lab. But it is an enzyme replacement therapy of ENPP1, because like I mentioned earlier, ENPP1 is one of the major enzyme that generates pyrophosphate, or PPI. Mm-hmm. PPI is a key molecule to prevent calcification in your soft tissues and your vasculature. And patients with ENPP1 deficiency lose 90% of their PPI. They do not make barely any PPI. Mm-hmm. So they lose this protection, which is really key and important. ABCC6 deficient patients have only 50% lower levels of PPI. So that's where there's a difference sometimes in the disease, especially in pediatric and adults presentation of the disease. But our INZ-701 is an enzyme replacement therapy. So it's a ENPP1 that we give back to the patients through a subcutaneous injection. And there is a substrate ATP present in the body, and that will basically generate PPI because our drug is active. And in our clinical trials, we've seen that we can bring the pyrophosphate levels from or undetectable in some patients or very like of 90% below into the healthy volunteer range.
Wow, really? That
within,
high?
Within 6 hours.
And then it gets
really sustained throughout our trials, which we're very happy to see. And so then that's where we're very excited about.
So it's taking, you know, it's called ENPP1 deficiency. So you're basically giving, as you said, like that enzyme replacement so that what the body doesn't produce on its own, you're saying, all right, here you go.
Exactly.
And the calcifications is a big part of what then leads to the symptoms. So if you're, that leads to less calcifications, so then therefore less symptoms.
Correct. Or at least more mild symptoms. Halt progression of the disease.
Okay.
That's what we've seen in our preclinical data in the mouse models. There's a mouse model of ENPP1, which we've published a couple of years ago. So it is because pyrophosphate, what happens, the calcification is basically calcium phosphate crystals forming, and the pyrophosphate will interfere in that formation and the growth of these crystals. So that's where it's like a break.
It there.
Exactly.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Wow. Well, this is very promising. I think, you know, just being able to see just the initial data you have is amazing. Of the interviews I've done and the clinical trials I learned about, usually we don't see those kind of results this quickly. So for people in the audience to really take in that this is very impressive.
Yeah.
Congratulations just on this initial data. Yeah. I can't even imagine once we have, you know, the clinical trials are finished.
Yeah, the community is very excited. It's a beacon of hope for us.
Yeah, thank you both so much for coming on and just sharing both of your expertise and, Christine, of just your personal experience and your family's experience. I think that it is just so important to be looping patient advocates into these conversations and hearing directly from you. And I am so happy to hear Enozyme is very much doing that, and that the relationship between Enozyme and Gatke Global is just so close. So I think that there's a lot of hope on the horizon, and that the clinical trials are already underway and everything is just really exciting. So we'll have to check back once some of the clinical trials are done and say, okay, here's where we're at. And then once you're FDA approved and all of the milestones that are yet to come for the ENPP1 deficiency community. So thank you both so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
The genes of you and me, they're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
Thanks for watching DNA Today. To access all of our episodes, head over to dnatoday.com. We also have a lot of bonus content on there that you can enjoy. If you have any questions, comments, suggestions, guest pitches, you name it, send them in to info@dnatoday.com. We'd also really appreciate if you could take a moment to rate and review the podcast on Apple, Spotify, wherever you listen to the show. It really helps more nerds like yourself find the show. Also, if you like giveaways and other ways to connect with us, I recommend following us on social. We're at DNA Today Podcast. We also have a Patreon if you want to be the most level involved in the show. That's also at DNA Today Podcast. Thank you so much for listening and watching. Join us next time to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.